Welcome to Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. I'm David Klink.
And I'm Troy Harkin.
You know, before we get into our episode proper on the TV series Kolchak, the Night Stalker, we wanted to take a few minutes to pay tribute to the life and career of filmmaker David Lynch.
We definitely do. Lynch was an extraordinarily... that's going to be my word for the day. Lynch was an extraordinary talent among his contemporaries. Unlike most of his peers, he came to film from the world of painting. And as a result, his films were always visually arresting, while his narratives were unconventional. His stories were not nearly as driven by linear narrative as the rest of Hollywood. But that was Lynch.
Definitely. His body of work defied basically traditional categorization. Though his films often had undeniable elements of the genres that we deal with on Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi, for example, Eraserhead has been described as horror. I can see that. While his adaptation of Herbert's Dune is clearly science fiction.
Yeah. Now, although Twin Peaks is ostensibly a procedural with the mystery of the death of Laura Palmer at its heart, Twin Peaks also involves elements of science fiction. We had Major Briggs and his investigation into aliens, into the alien messages and UFOs, as well as supernatural horror, the murderous entity known as Bob. These blurrings of boundaries occur throughout his body of work.
And all of his films either won or were nominated for major awards. And all his works were nominated 48 times, winning 25 times.
And in 2018, the Oxford English Dictionary included the word Lynchian. It is defined as, quote, characteristic, reminiscent, or imitative of the films of films or television work of David Lynch. Lynch is noted for juxtaposing surreal or sinister elements with mundane, everyday environments, and for using compelling visual images to emphasize a dreamlike quality of mystery or menace. And we, after the passing of Lynch, Dave, we checked out a few things together and on our own, and man, what a ride, eh?
Yeah, thanks for inviting me up to the old man cave that you've got, and we're able to. You introduced me to a couple of films I had not seen. You know how there's always gaps, and where people, everyone has those films that everyone said, "Oh, you should have watched that," but hadn't. I certainly like Mulholland Drive. I liked Dune. I like Twin Peaks. There was Elephant Man, I think, was Lynch also, right? Mm-hmm. Which is incredible. I'd like to watch that again. But the ones I missed somehow, you introduced to me, which were Blue Velvet and Eraserhead. So I got to watch it for the first time when you had seen these five or 10 times or however many times. So it's kind of fun watching Blue Velvet, and I'm sort of making, I probably shouldn't have made comments. I should have just sat there with my mouth shut, noshing on things and basically just enjoying the moment. But I just, you know, I'm not trying to spoil anything because you've already seen it 10 times. But, you know, there are things I just noticed or thought and said, well, this is going to happen or this, which doesn't mean it's bad filmmaking. It's just that he set it up in such a way that you know that the story has to go forward, and you're almost stuck, and you're in a position where you can't do anything about it, which itself is almost feels like horror.
Yeah, that's right. And it's funny that, you know, Blue Velvet was one of those films for you to watch because it's one of the few Lynch films that has a traditional linear structure. You know, if we were to do that with Mulholland Drive or Lost Highway, we would have no clue. You know, it's like we couldn't say, oh, we know what's going to go on here. But Blue Velvet, you can. Blue Velvet's actually the first film of his that I saw in the theater. I had a couple of friends who had already seen Eraserhead, and we would get together and watch that on VCR back in the day. And we were waiting for the first proper Lynch film because Dune had been out, but of course, Dune was an adaptation that he made with or I guess you could say for Dino De Laurentiis, on the agreement that De Laurentiis would do Blue Velvet, would produce Blue Velvet for Lynch. So he agreed to direct Dune. And Elephant Man as well, he directed, but clearly not an original script by Lynch. So we had two great films that were visually stunning, but Blue Velvet was like, okay, now we're going to get to see Lynch be Lynch again, like we did with Eraserhead. And after it was over, it got a standing ovation. I'll never forget that in the theater, where people just like stood and clapped, you know, with that movie when it first came out. And Eraserhead, you know, it is clearly one of the strangest films ever. And I just found out this week, David, that it was Stanley Kubrick's favorite film. He would invite people to his screening room, including people like Lucas. He said, you've got to come see this film. This is my favorite film. And he just really loved having people over and laying Eraserhead on them. And Lynch was very happy when he learned that from somebody who had been invited over. He said, you know, Stanley is bringing people over and showing them Eraserhead and saying it's his favorite film. And he was quite taken aback by that, because he loved Kubrick. He has said as well that Lolita was a huge influence on him, on Lynch. And you can kind of see that, because when you think about Blue Velvet a little bit, but Twin Peaks in particular, it has this vibe that is throughout Lolita. And I was even thinking that James Mason looks a little bit like the actor who played Leland Palmer, Laura's father. I forget the name of the actor, but anyway, he looks a lot like James Mason, and he kind of carries himself like James Mason, as is the character's name Humbert, I believe, in Lolita. Anyway, I just thought that was cool that there was this kind of mutual respect between Kubrick and Lynch. But we're gonna miss him for sure. It would actually kind of I rewatched Mulholland Drive this week, or, you know, in fact, I think it was the first time I saw Mulholland Drive from beginning to end. I had at various points in my life seen segments of it, but never in its entirety. And man, that's also I think it's technically, this is cinephile terminology. It's a mind fuck. I think that comes from the French. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I've collected up pins, talk about these are the best mindfuck movies, various genres and so on. And it definitely fits in there. Blue Velvet also had a villain that was might be one of the best portrayed, best written, best acted role, Dennis Hopper.
Yeah. Yeah. Villains in Lynch films and TV are incredible, because there's something that, like, Lynch knows not just what scares us, but what bothers us. And the villains that he has on screen are very disturbing. So you get Frank Booth in Blue Velvet, played by Dennis Hopper. Another favorite of mine, or most disturbing, is Willem Dafoe playing Bobby Peru, I believe is the character's name, in Wild at Heart. Man, that's a creepy dude. Like, you can smell this guy's breath. Like, there's just, they have Willem Dafoe wearing these like prosthetic bad teeth, and holy crap, he gets really, really close to Laura Dern, and there's like a super close up of their two faces together, and you can just smell his breath. And of course, there's Bob in Blue Velvet. And you mentioned actually the character from Dune, right? Some people are now pronouncing it like it's my name. They're not saying the Harkonnens. They're saying the Harkonnens or something like that. In the more
yes,
recent
exactly.
Dunes. Yeah.
Yeah, he draws the characters well, and you believe it. You believe just how odd. Plus, his group of followers, the people that he hangs out with, are also in their, not in the right mind, let's put it that way. And yeah. I watch it was kind of neat because, you know, there's that scene where you see from a distance a red vehicle and you see someone, and I was thinking, okay, that person's clearly, I didn't know right away that it was Dennis Hopper in disguise. It wasn't, you know, Booth's character.
The well-dressed man.
Exactly. But clearly, like I was going to say this when I was watching with you, wow, that's interesting. This guy clearly has got some kind of wig or hair thing and a fake mustache. And yeah. It's just so over the top. It's obvious that this guy is being, plus the very first moment with Dorothy Valens, Isabella Rossellini's character. And when she gets into the apartment, I was going to say, okay, well, she's just going to take her wig off.
Yeah. I'm sharing this with you, but obviously all the listeners as well. I just remembered something, that there was a segment in Blue Velvet that never appeared, I don't, in any of the cuts, but in the original script, Kyle MacLachlan's character is a university student, and one of the very first scenes was supposed to be a scene where Kyle MacLachlan's character is, I think it's in a boiler room in some building at the university, and he's watching either some sexual assault happen or he's just watching two people getting it on, and he's being voyeuristic. And either he gets caught and gets thrown out of university and that's why he comes home, or it's just something that we see and it sort of sets up the fact that he's got voyeurism as part of his personality. But it was decided not to add that into the actual film. But I'm always aware of that now when I watch it, you know, like Jeffrey likes to watch.
Yeah, and I think this is one of those cases possible. I'd have to look it up more, because I think there was a film, I think it might have been the 1982 film, The Thing, that Roger Ebert sort of panned or didn't like or gave it a thumbs down. And then and there are certain films where people talked to him and said, you might have missed this. And he was a big enough man to actually watch it like 5 or 10 years later, rewatch it with, because you never know what's going on in your life or other things to make you feel that, oh, for this reason, I don't like this or what have you. But upon later view, that's also a film that has grown over time to people more appreciate. Because I think his review, like I watched this segment of Ebert reviewing Blue Velvet, and let's just say that was not a thumbs up.
Blue Velvet is a movie that really challenges you to think about your reactions to it. And my reaction is, I think this movie is cruelly unfair to its actors. It was directed by David Lynch, the same man who made Eraserhead and Dune. And he's a talented director. You can see that here in scenes that have a lot of power. But he asked Isabella Rossellini in this movie to be undressed and humiliated on the screen, as few actresses ever have been, certainly in non-porno roles. And then he tries to take the edge off her shocking scenes by turning the whole thing into some kind of a joke. Well, either this material is funny, in which case you don't take advantage of your stars, or it isn't funny, in which case it shouldn't have so much campy and adolescent dialogue along with the really powerful sexual scenes. Sure, the movie's well made, but the more I thought about it, the less I liked it.
Well, I liked it, and I thought about it a lot, and I think you may be on the wrong tack in trying to feel sorry for Isabella Rossellini, because after all, she consented to do what she did on the screen, number one. Number two, I'm sure she's walking around wherever she lives, New York City or whatever, and survived the whole experience, just like Janet Leigh survived the shower scene in Psycho. So I don't think that that's pertinent.
I'm sure he must have changed his mind over time.
Yeah, and Siskel did a good job of pushing back on that in that one, too. And the really interesting thing is the scene that he was most upset with was when Isabella Rossellini appears fully naked on Jeffrey's doorstep, basically his family's doorstep. Yeah. And everybody sees her, including Laura Dern, who, you know, they're starting to become intimate. Laura Dern's character and Kyle MacLachlan's character. The thing is that scene is so fundamental to the film, because Lynch has stated that that's something that he remembered from childhood, where he was, wherever he was living in the Northwest at the time. I believe it was Washington State. And then he was getting ready to go in after playing outside, and it was dusk. And he said, all of a sudden, this naked woman appeared out of nowhere. And she was in distress, and he had never seen a naked woman before. And it just, like, you know, ingrained itself in his psyche, this image. And so that's why it's in the film. It's not exploitive. You know, it's not there for the sake of it. It's there because the story is built around that moment.
Exactly. That's what that psychopathic killer would do. He would strip every sense of decency and whatever from that person, just leave them. It's sort of like Cersei in Game of Thrones with that walk of shame. You've got nothing left. Like, you are as bare as you can be, without any hope, without, you know, the protections that you would expect. And the kind of person that would do that to someone, clearly there's something very much of a psychotic break there.
Yeah. And I've got to say, I am sad that we are going to be living in a world without David Lynch, because, you know, his imagination was just so fertile. And he gave us so much that I definitely am going to miss him as a filmmaker. And also, you know, he was huge into popularizing meditation. It's always been a part of his life. I didn't mean to do this as a Beatlism, because I have one later, but he has had a few concerts, because both Ringo and Paul McCartney are still huge into transcendental meditation. And Lynch has been fundamental in promoting meditation in schools, in penitentiaries, to make life better for these people. And he was just a huge believer in meditation. So despite the fact that sometimes his work seemed chaotic, he certainly had a passive, peaceful side to him.
Portions of today's program are mechanically reproduced. And now keep your dial set on Channel 26 for the finest of television programming.
There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission.
Relief. You two take care of labor.
Only intended for a plane cap.
Danger! Danger! Man your stations! Vehicle in direct path of meteor storm!
You don't want to die of cold. Toll free.
Look, I'm a doctor, not an escalator. Spock, give me a hand.
I'll give you trouble!
Pop your piece around the track if you get
nails and more nails.
Have you ever tried to report a UFO sighting?
I'll save you the trouble. There is not a single government agency still in existence that will admit to any interest in the subject. If you seem to be insistent, they will refer you to a private organization.
Okay, let's move on to today's episode covering Kolchak the Night Stalker. Here's the synopsis from the back of my DVD collection. Emmy nominee Darren McGavin stars as Carl Kolchak. Oh, and pardon me, I'm probably going to say Kolchak, even though it's, I guess, Kolchak, but it's just something I've been doing all my life. So it's, pardon me for that. Anyway, so it stars Emmy nominee Darren McGavin as Carl Kolchak, a headstrong investigative reporter on the trail of the God, I can't talk today, Dave. He's a reporter and he's on the trial. No, he's not. He's not on trial. He's on the trail of the paranormal. That means zombies, vampires, werewolves, ghosts, succubi, and even aliens. No matter how unnatural or unbelievable, Kolchak is there to uncover the truth, one supernatural threat at a time. Although the show is set in Chicago, it was filmed in LA utilizing stock footage and B-roll of Chicago, and they actually do a nice job of that. You see a lot of Chicago in these episodes.
The show aired on ABC from September 13, 1974 to March 28, 1975. The series, as we said, followed two very successful movies of the week, The Night Stalker and The Night Strangler. If you have not seen these, please check these out. We've also discussed these before when we covered something on Richard Matheson and the ABC movie of the week. So these were both written by those movies of the week were written by Richard Matheson and produced by Dan Curtis. Those are just stunning achievements. But neither Curtis nor Matheson were involved with the short-lived series. There were only 20 episodes were produced. And thank you for letting me borrow the DVD set. There were five discs. There were four episodes per disc, and I watched all of them in the order that's listed on the DVD. Sometimes these series are a bit odd that they, you know, they play episodes in different orders, and it gets a bit confusing. But Kolchak, The Night Stalker airs on, or at least aired on Friday nights and Saturday nights on ABC, 1974 to 1975. We're doing this show in 2025. So we're talking about 50 years. Can you believe it's been 50 years since we as young kids watched Kolchak, The Night Stalker?
It's
I can't get my head around it. Yeah.
No,
the show was originally broadcast on Friday nights at 10 p.m., but was moved to 8 p.m. in January 1975. And the final 4 weeks of the show aired on Saturday nights at 8 p.m.
And that's like the kiss of death. Like that's when they were like, yeah, whatever. Yep. Like just put it there and put something else into Friday. It's interesting to look at the logjam of shows on Friday nights in 1974, David. CBS had Planet of the Apes, which was our last episode. And right there, Planet of the Apes and Kolchak likely split their genre audience, right? I would have been watching Planet of the Apes, but if I was a little bit older, I would have been really torn, like for a regular basis, which way am I going to go? NBC had the hits Sanford and Son, Chico and the Man, The Rockford Files, and Policewoman. Like, no, that's all on the same night. And that's what they were going up against. That's what both Planet of the Apes and Kolchak was going up against. Like, they couldn't buy a break if they were on Friday night. And so nobody was going to touch NBC on a Friday night in the mid-1970s. To make matters worse, ABC didn't have a strong lead-in, which you need, right? Like you need to have like a couple of shows, like how there was Chico and the Man and Sanford and Son together, because then you don't flip away, right?
Right.
They had ABC had a sitcom called The Texas Wheelers, which I don't remember at all. And it only lasted 8 episodes. Like when you get canceled before 13, you know, there's a problem. Like they're like, pull the plug on the life support. Like just get like, let it go, let it slide. Like the baby in Eraserhead, right? Like let that thing be out of its misery. So anyway, fun fact, the Texas Wheelers starred a young Mark Hamill. I didn't know that Mark Hamill did anything that we would have seen prior to Star Wars, but he was in this show called Texas Wheelers. And that show was followed by Kodiak, an adventure series that only lasted 13 episodes. Now, here's the weird thing, too. It's like, why do you put a show on the air called Kodiak when there's already, well, you've got another one called Kolchak and you've got another one called, what's the one with Telly Savalas? Kojak.
Right.
Like they are all airing at the same time. You think that you might think, well, just for the sake of confusion, let's call it something else like Big Bear or Cocaine Bear, you know?
Right.
It's like, but Kodiak? Anyway, okay. I'm going to take a break from my frustration, Dave. I'll let you Tag up.
So, unlike virtually every other TV show we've looked at this season, Kolchak, I don't even know if I can even say it right. Kolchak, the Night Stalker, had, as far as I'm aware, no merchandise tie-ins. So no board games, no Viewmaster reels, no lunchboxes, no action figures, no Play-Doh sets, no Nerf steak and crucifix sets, and no Kolchak Halloween costumes of a middle-aged man in a seersucker suit and a straw hat. I would have bought this. Not even a Corgi diecast yellow Mustang convertible. That car was beautiful.
Yeah. Because, again, going back to Planet of the Apes, even though that series had a run actually even less long as Kolchak, it had a ton of merchandise that would at least bring money back to Universal or whatever. But Kolchak had nothing.
Mm.
Yeah. So despite the show's brief run and its utter lack of original memorabilia, the show was not forgotten. It was not lost to the sands of time. Somehow it has endured. And it seems pretty clear to me that the reason for it being remembered is single-handedly attributable to Darren McGavin. Not only was McGavin Kolchak, like he was this character, he helped to birth the character by designing the costume that Karl Kolchak wore. He also oversaw the show as an uncredited and uncompensated executive producer. And it was that lack of remuneration that led to McGavin asking to be released from the series. And in the end, ABC decided to release the series itself.
Yeah, and one of the things we've done in previous seasons, the idea of recasting shows or maybe bringing things back with a younger group of actors or whatever, but I can't even imagine anyone else being Kolchak the Night Stalker than Darren McGavin. I just don't see it.
He was the one. Although I think I might have mentioned to you, I would love to see Peter Billingsley play him, because, you know, in Christmas Story, McGavin was his father. And when they did the recent reboot of A Christmas Story, it's called A Christmas Story, or you'll find it. Now that Peter Billingsley is older and kind of grizzled, he kind of looks like Darren McGavin, which is weird because they weren't related by blood. They just played his father. But I thought that would be kind of cool if he got to play a Kolchak.
Oh, absolutely. Despite the show's untimely demise, it lived on, whispered of in the night, remembered fondly by old farts like us, that's for sure. And we'll talk later about, there were a few episodes that just stood with me that I thought were absolutely just terrified me and were just absolutely brilliant, and still hold up somehow. And by television creators like Chris Carter, because it's well known that Chris Carter did mention before he did X-Files that the Kolchak the Night Stalker was definitely affected him. And he thought, why not update this kind of show or just come up with something where you are looking at the paranormal? And the X-Files was a great series. And maybe there wouldn't have been an X-Files if there wasn't a Night Stalker.
And I definitely get the vibe with Mulder, because like Mulder has this thing where, yes, he's very serious about his work, but he also has this really he's got a great sense of humor. I'm just going to leave it at that. He's got a great sense of humor, as does Kolchak. Mm-hmm. So let's have a look at the cast of the TV series, Kolchak the Night Stalker. Take it away, David.
Well, it starts, and I know that you had mentioned how important Darren McGavin is, and we'll start with him, of course. But one of the things that is key to the series for me is also his relationship with the Vincenzo. But anyways, let's start with Darren McGavin. So Darren McGavin was Karl Kolchak, the intrepid investigative reporter. He keeps mentioning and showing his ID, saying INS. And we're almost thinking, is this someone who's going to pick up some illegal people or something, or maybe it's Internal Revenue Service, or no one has ever heard of this group. But anyways, McGavin had a long career in film and television, working steadily from the 1940s onward. Other than Kolchak, he is remembered for his roles in The Natural, one of our favorite films, A Christmas Story, of course, Millennium, and The X-Files.
David, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I need to interject an important note here. Let's remind folks that in the original $6 million man pilot, Darren McGavin played the proto Oscar Goldman character, Oliver Spencer. And weirdly, in the second Kolchak movie of the week, The Night Strangler, Richard Anderson, who played Oscar Goldman in the $6 million man, played the time defying villain, Dr. Richard Malcolm. I just had to mention that because it's very weird that these guys sort of like cross paths in such a direct way.
Yep. And while we're at it, we should remind listeners that we did cover the original Kolchak movie of the week. Of course, we already mentioned this earlier about the Night Stalker and Richard Matheson movie of the week episode, which dropped earlier this season. And definitely, if you haven't heard that one, please go back and listen to it, because we're certainly fans of those movie of the week because they're just great. And of course, fans of Richard Matheson. So, okay, back to Kolchak. Simon Oakland as Tony Vincenzo. How perfect is Simon Oakland in this role?
Yeah. He's dead on perfect. Yes.
Oh my.
A++.
Well, that's not the point. I assign the stories. The idea is for you to do what you are supposed to do. There was a shooting in Scorpino's restaurant. Two men with shotguns just blasted little Augie Cesari and his two bodyguards. Looks like a turf war, Carl.
Well, they're always shooting each other.
You don't seem too interested, Carl.
Oh, I'm on a story. And you always say, one story at a time, Carl, one story at a time. Besides, there's never any news in those gang killings.
You don't think there's anything printable here?
Nah, nobody ever talks. It was the last one I covered was typical. Of the 30 people in the restaurant, 20 of them claimed to be in the men's room, and the rest of them claimed never to have heard one of the 18 shots that were fired. All right, I'll cover it. But it's a waste of time, as you'd know if you'd ever done one.
If I've done one? How do you think I got behind that desk?
I don't know how.
I was top crime reporter in this town when it was important, when it was dangerous. If you weren't careful, you could wind up under a Pierce Arrow.
Oh, boy, that was a long time ago, Tony. Yeah, you've probably forgotten how. No, I'll do it.
No. I'm going to show you how to dig out a story.
Well, good for you, Mr. Vincenzo. I like to see older people with spunk.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So he's a Kolchak's crotchety, ulcer-ridden editor. Oakland appeared on both The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits. He was also in Hitchcock's Psycho and West Side Story, among many other roles he's played. Once you see him in a movie or something, you just recognize him right away. John Greenidge played Ron Updike, who is another journalist at INS. Carl sometimes calls him Uptight instead of Updike. And weirdly, Updike does look a bit like Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the first time I saw him, I thought, oh my God, it's Chris Hadfield. How is this possible? And then I realized it's not possible.
Yeah, and of course it's Hadfield as opposed to Hatfield. But
oh, right. Yeah, he's not Metallica. Although I guess maybe he could have been, because he played Bowie in Outer Space. Maybe he could play Entered Sandman in Outer Space.
I would pay to see that. Although this was his biggest recurring role, Greenidge also appeared in Rebel Without a Cause, the Elvis film Kid Creole, as well as on The Twilight Zone. What a combination of films and TV shows that was.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not going to do a lot, that covers your bases pretty nicely.
Ruth McDevitt is one of our favorite characters on the show. She plays Emily Cowles, and what a great character. Although Ruth McDevitt was born in 1895.
Holy Moses.
Yeah. Her first on-screen role did not come until 1949, which with my quick math is about the age of 54 or 55 or so.
Yeah.
Among her long list of film and TV roles, McDevitt appeared in The Birds, The Shakiest Gun in the West. Is it MAME?
Yep.
And on Room 222, Kojak. McCloud and Gunsmoke before going on to Kolchak, the Night Stalker. Now, she passed away in 1975 at the age of 80, so I guess it wasn't that much after the show. The show ran from 74 to 75.
Yeah, she probably, so it sounds like she probably passed away. What, like, you know, they did the original run of shows, and she may have even died before the season was done. Clearly was done filming, but yeah, it had not finished airing. Yeah, I really like her character as well, because on the previous, going back to sort of the Night Strangler, there is a female coworker, but their relationship is much more antagonistic than it is with Emily Cowles, who is really nice. She has like really this grandmotherly quality. I always feel like she's kind of like taking Kolchak under her wing, or somehow taking care of her.
Yeah, and also a certain sequence and very important parts of various episodes, she's actually supporting him and helping him out. There's all these little bits, and you say, wow, what a good person she is. And my favorite episode, we'll get into this a bit later, is Horror in the Heights, and she plays an important role in that as well. And of course, there was a whole stellar list. This is, we're only talking about 20 episodes, but with the guest stars including Carolyn Jones, Scatman Crothers, Phil Silvers, who just, we love Phil Silvers, Stella Stevens, Jim Backus, Jamie Farr, Antonio Fargas, Tom Skerritt, Kathy Lee Crosby, and Tom Bosley. So what a great list of actors and actresses.
So let's talk a little bit about the episode structure of the show, because it does have a very particular format. And now all TV is like this. That's the thing. All television, you know, to make it easier for the writers who are doing episodic TV, you kind of have certain things have to happen in a certain way. But when we do these rewatches, you become super aware of it. You know, you become super aware of what's going to happen when. And when I sort of broke this down, I wish I had added the acts, because TV, as I recall, goes with a five act structure. But I did not apply the five acts to this, but it becomes sort of obvious anyway. So, all television shows of this era have a fairly well-defined, one might say predictable structure. So here is sort of the shakedown of Kolchak the Night Stalker for our listeners. We would start with Kolchak's opening voiceover.
This is one story. I mean, I get to file in person, so I'll have to talk fast because it's after me. Claustrophobia has long been a part of the human experience from the Cro-Magnon all the way up to Freud. So if you ever happen to find yourself underground, I mean deep underground, don't linger in the shadows.
That quickly sets up the first murder by the Monster of the Week. And now I know the term Monster of the Week's been around for a while, but I was hard pressed to think of another show that might actually have a Monster of the Week prior to this. Maybe.
Well, there was. Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
Yes, I was going to say Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
Fell into that.
Who fill in the blank, like Mummy, Dracula, Vampire, Werewolf. So, yeah, there you go.
That's usually a bad attribution to it. Like, if a show is a show and it does all these things and you run through it season by season, but the idea of a show becoming what they call a Monster of the Week is just something. They're going to throw something in some weird costume and they're going to have to deal with it. And then if that happens week after week, that's like a jump in the shark moment. Basically, it's not a good. If you say a series of Monster of the Week, that's usually a bad thing. Now, with a series like The Night Stalker, that's the point. He is finding,
right.
That's the whole point of the show.
Yeah, yeah. And Smallville definitely got into that as well. So we
then get into the, after the whole idea of the first murder, as we do get into the whole opening title segment, Kolchak whistles his own theme song as we see him alone at night prepping a story for INS. And that's a really cool,
yes,
moment. Like rewatching all of this stuff and some of the more recent things, you might be able to skip these, but you go through that whole opening sequence. And it reminds me, I think we've talked about this before. We were both sort of that age. where we were still pecking away our little short stories or our little ideas on Smith Coronas or Blackwoods or some kind of a type. Yeah, I still have one or two of those typewriters from the early 70s where I would just be typing along and have to sometimes change the ribbon or what have
you. Get your liquid paper out.
Exactly. And then you have the carriage return. The whole idea of the carriage return and line feed is almost something that eventually got into computers as well, where there's codes at the end of a line that represent the same thing as if you get through a typewriter. And just seeing that typewriter, including the case, because I had one of these little cases that I don't know why you'd be walking to a lot of places with your typewriter, but you could at least.
Well, I think it was essentially, you know, the way people have like travel with their laptop now.
Yep.
You know, and you even absolutely. See. Now, I don't know how authentic it was, but I assume it was authentic. And there's two different Hunter S. Thompson films, one with Bill Murray and one with Johnny Depp playing Hunter S. Thompson. And they have him like lugging an IBM Selectric around on his hip, you know, like under his arm on his hip. And those things, like I got one right beside me and they are about 30 pounds, I'm going to guess.
Well, those are big things, and that we all went through the whole eventually to computers because the typewriters eventually had this little line of before you actually type the thing, you can actually go and edit that line on this little display. Then it was several lines, and then you had this electric ones, and then you could change the actual ball in the front, and eventually we got to computers. But anyways, so to get back to Kolchak,
that's been a typewriter minute with Troy and Dave.
Investigates. We already get into the idea of the monster of the week. There was a murder. There's an opening title sequence. He's prepping a story that he has to investigate because there's something odd about the crime scene, something that seems otherworldly or something. And of course, he gets brushed off and treated harshly by the cops at the scene of the crime.
Yeah. Often we get more murders and Kolchak gets more rough treatment by cops. Kolchak interviews people. He goes undercover and unearths supernatural elements. He then, of course, has at least by now, he has to have had a run-in with editor Tony Vincenzo.
Yeah, but Tony, it was worth it. Almost. Listen, I got some pictures in here like you.
Carl, I don't want to hear anything more about that giant newt. I want you to keep away from the authorities in Marymount.
Rip the lid off of this lizard creature affair, and I'm going to find out who those guys in the water department really are. And you, stop talking with your mouth full.
Don't tell me what to do with my mouth.
You know, I think all that bicarbonate you've been drinking has put bubbles in your brain.
The issue is not my intake of bicarbonate. The issue is how you follow my directives. Now, I'm trying to establish a professional working rapport with this lieutenant.
Oh, that's...
And I don't want you jeopardizing it. Now, you've aggravated this sweet young woman in spite of all the kindnesses she's extended to you.
Kindness?
Yes.
That sweet young woman is about as kind as an SS Sturmbannführer.
Now, Carl,
I'm getting out of Marymount.
Vincenzo!
Don't yell like you always do. It'll rile your bile.
Yeah, because it's almost in every episode where Vincenzo has assigned stories and Kolchak is supposed to be doing this story that is just sounds boring to all of it. And we think, why are you even doing this? But on the side, he's pushing him off. He's not finishing that, whatever that story is. He's working on this interesting one that's all the plot for the show. So So he has to duck out. He's always trying to get away from Vincenzo. They have these arguments. And then there's more investigating, another run-in with Vincenzo, which is why you watch the show.
Yes, right.
You exactly. watch the show when these guys are butting heads and just going at it is the show. It's like Boston Legal, where you have the two actors on the balcony sitting on chairs and talking at the end. Yeah, Shatner and Spader. You get like, this is why you watch this show. And perhaps there's yet again another murder.
Yeah, because even if the monster that week is lame, you know, you're still going to have great moments with Vincenzo and Kolchak. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So then Kolchak follows his lead and confronts the monster of the week. They slip his grasp, and Kolchak is left without any hard evidence of the monster in question. Often his tape or his pictures are ruined, but he's always left without any hard evidence.
Yeah. Of course, his camera often gets taken. The film is torn out, and so on. He's got left with nothing. So basically, and he has to do this week in, week out. So it's a bit of a hard on him. But we do wrap up with the epilogue and a closing. And this is another great moment, is that Kolchak voiceover following the credits about sort of summarizing things and stuff is really nice.
But if you're in a subway or a pedestrian tunnel underneath a ballpark and you think you hear something moving in the walls, it may not be your imagination. Take my advice. Don't walk. Run to the nearest exit.
Yeah, and it's it does flow nicely. Like, that's one of the things that does make this series work is you want that structure that they give you, and you sort of anticipate the Vincenzo run-ins and everything. Dave, I just wanted to throw in a quick Beatlesm here, where in the final episode, we're going to talk about episodes in a second, but in the final episode entitled "The Sentry," Police Lieutenant Lamont calls Carl's yellow Mustang convertible the Yellow Submarine. So, of course, I was very excited to hear that. And of course, made note of it. So let's jibber-jabber a little bit about our favorite Kolchak the Night Stalker episodes. I have a couple of quick notes, and then I'll hand it over to you, Dave. I really liked The Ripper. A bunch of the first ones I really liked, like The Ripper, The Vampire, they really hold up for me. The Chopper is a bit of a guilty pleasure, which we can talk a little bit more about. Mr. Ring. I know I loved that as a kid. I saw that as a kid. And of course I loved it because it was very $6 million man-like. Mm. You know, this was essentially... like the world of the fembots and whatnot, except it was not a woman. It was a male robot
like character Westworld come to life.
Yeah. Of course, the faceplate, as we have mentioned a few times during our TV season, how, you know, the 70s were all about robots and their faceplates coming off. So, we get that in Mr. Ring. And the Sentry, although they totally rip off a Star Trek episode, which was The Devil in the Dark, season 1, episode 25, where a monster is protecting its eggs in an underground mining facility. Now, it's got a pretty high cheese factor, but I still enjoyed it. I think it was partly that weird, I don't even know if it's like kosher to call it sexual tension, but there was this definitely a weird sexual tension going on between the female lieutenant and Kolchak. And there is that monster that is it looks like the Gorn that is down the hall. And it's in a mining facility. And when you shoot anything in a long hallway, it makes it really difficult to like cut away and to not show things that you don't want to show. And we see too much of this monster, unfortunately, but it still was a good time. An episode I found really bad, and I did not check other people's ratings, but Nightly Murders I found like almost unwatchable. It was very, very Scooby-Doo with the haunted suit of armor. What about you, Dave? What thoughts did you have on standout episodes or ones you wanted to mention, or good or bad?
Yeah, there's certainly ones that in my and just from memory and from watching them all again, the ones that stood out for me when I had watched it originally back in the 70s, there were two that scared me the most. One of which was the motorcycle, because that whole idea, because basically very similar, it feels to me like the Headless Horseman story.
Right.
But it's updated. Like instead of being on a horse, he's on a motorcycle. And I can see how that's a quick, you know, one of those things. Oh, we'll have a headless horseman on a motorcycle. And they say, okay, write the script. You've got to go.
Yeah. And the thing about
that one. Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing when you do it now as a modern viewer, you know, you're very aware of the effect being not sophisticated. Clearly, they did not have CGI back then.
It was. You mentioned that, like when you see the guy on the motorcycle and it's clear, why don't you describe it to me? Cause it's,
well, it's almost like you see this sometimes in parades where certain clowns are built up to look tall. And basically they've just put the shoulders up higher so you don't see the person's head. And then there's a fake head. But in this case, there isn't a fake clown's head. They've built the shoulders up above the height of the person's head, and then they see through this sort of disguised dark chest thing. But it's so high, the shoulders are so high, it makes
it obvious.
Like,
yeah.
It makes Herman Munster look like Hervé Villechev or something, you know. it's way too big. Yeah.
And as a kid, I didn't mind it that much. No. Like I just like as an adult or just watching it again, I was thinking, but even then it's still scary. You've got the what is the actual part of the neck, the skeletal part of the spine that would hold the head coming out of the actual suit at the top. Now, and this has been 50 years, so there shouldn't be any spoiler alerts, but the ending where he's actually been able to find the skull in a box and was able to throw it at him.
Right.
When I first watched that, that was so indelibly.
Oh, it was
like,
good.
I saw, you know, I was watching it so careful. Like when I was watching it, I was thinking, wow. And when he throws it, it's clear that it hits whatever the thing is and bounces off to the side. Like you can see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I first watched it. And then when I watched it again, yeah, the thing bounces off to the right and it just goes away. But then later on, it's clear that no, that isn't what actually happened. If they had the effects or able to manage it, it would have been clear that when he threw it, it attached to the actual body. So at the end of the episode, you see the body down there with the head attached. And I was thinking, well, if it went away, how did that skull then somehow crawl back or somehow get attached to the body of the motorcyclist?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I never understood that.
They're asking a lot. They're asking a lot in terms of our suspension of disbelief. But yeah, it's funny. Yeah. Like ever since
now, we for talked my about favorite,
it, I just wanted to say that ever since we talked about the chopper episode 15, I was thinking, well, they could have done it. Like clearly they could have done it. Now, okay, first of all, I will say I know why they didn't do this. I know why they went with what they had. It's television, and you would have had probably, I'm guessing, six shooting days. I think Bionic Woman ended up bringing it into 7 days. But so I think the norm back then was 6 shooting days. And so that's basically why we end up with the effects that we do. But had they been given even an extra day, what they could have done is, first of all, I would have shot the motorcycle on a flatbed truck. I would not show it as long as from such a long point so you can see the weirdness of the shoulders. I would have done close-ups of parts of the bike. I would have shot then from behind the chopper rider with his head down, and you just bring up the collar a little bit, right? And then you get a couple shots from behind like this, which you can do if the cyclist is on a straightaway, right? Get some of that. Do a couple of like a mannequin locked off on a flatbed truck, right? Where he's just like holding like this, and then the neck is normal, right? You just take the head off the mannequin, and he's locked off like this. And there you go. There you have now a situation where you don't need to have a motorcycle rider with this freaking thing up here, like a foot higher than where his shoulder should be, and you're good to go. I just wanted to mention Larry Linville was in that. He was also in the original TV movie, and the episode was co-written, or the story was co-created by Robert Zemeckis. It was his first sale of a script, supposedly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yep. So I went into I sort of had my own list of what I thought were the best episodes or what
stayed. Let it rip.
And talked about the two episodes that did that I had the fondest memories of, or what number one, which is also rated the highest, is The Horror in the Heights. They have a description here that residents of the Roosevelt Heights neighborhood are being caught off guard and killed by a demon with the ability to appear as a person they know and trust, which is just such a great concept. We've seen that in Invasion of the Body Snatchers and another The Thing and so on, that the moment you can't, it can actually read. And some of the shots in that, like from the back where you see the actual creature parts from the back as it's approaching the people, but they see. And you should understand that if one of you sees your mother and the other person sees a police officer, that there's something weird going on there.
Yeah, yeah.
But Horror in the Heights is number one.
With the Hindu demon shapeshifter, which was a pretty cool concept.
Yeah, the Rakshasa.
Yeah.
Second episode would be The Ripper. No, go ahead.
Okay, sorry, I just wanted to interject there with Horror on the Heights, Dave. Yeah. During our Christmas episode that we did, I was saying that I didn't think that there was a Christmas episode because this Horror in the Heights aired the Christmas week, and it was the 11th episode. But I realized during the rewatch that episode 5, Werewolf, actually is kind of a Christmas episode. The whole opening of the first act is set at Christmas, and they're having like a Christmas party in the INS office. Yet that episode aired November 1st. So I thought it was kind of weird that what is ostensibly the Christmas episode of Kolchak aired November 1st, like so far away from Christmas. Anyway, then that one was a bit of a hoot for me, but go on. Tell me, let's talk about The Ripper.
The Ripper is one of their earliest episodes, and it's a really strong one. It almost feels also like a movie of the week.
Yep.
Kind of thing, similar to the Night Strangler and the vampire, their ability. I mean, it's amazing how many of these creatures you can just keep shooting them unless they're silver bullets or some special thing or have been blessed. They're not affected by it.
Yeah.
And the fact you can jump down 20 feet or 30 feet and not be injured. So basically with the Ripper, it's basically is Jack the Ripper, a black caped, bullet resistant, superhuman killer of women.
Like you say, it feels like almost like the third movie of the week because it has that similar aesthetic. It's gritty. It starts in a strip club, and you have like sort of various women of the night as part of the story. Well, and it's the Ripper. It did really feel like a continuation of that world. Like it hasn't gotten super safe and goofy yet.
So the vampire sent to LA to interview a controversial guru, Kolchak's more interested in tracking down and stopping extremely vicious female vampires. So this is kind of interesting because I don't know how many times you've run into women vampires, because certainly the first movie of the week, it was a man. And in this case, they sort of turn it upside down, sort of like the beginning of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the very first episode where you see this guy and this gal and they're sort of young and they're sort of teenagers and they for some reason want to go into a crypt. And you're thinking all along, based on how they're acting and the way they're talking, that the guy is the vampire and that he is going to harm the woman. But guess what? You turn it on its head.
I wanted to say, too, that I just heard last night that Buffy is coming back. There's going to be a new Buffy series with Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Wow, that would be, I think that would be worth watching, that's for sure. That was a great show.
You know, another one that sort of just hit me that I really did enjoy was episode 7, The Devil's Platform, where the politician sells his soul to Satan and he becomes a shape-shifting dog.
And there's Tom Skerritt?
Or yeah, right, pre the thing. Oh, hold yes. on, no, he, no or hold alien. On, he was not pre-alien, yeah. Yeah, he's just bearded and looks like he should be. Among those guys. And there's a great line in that show. It is, he's evil incarnate. He's going to go all the way to the White House.
That's perfect.
Yep.
It only took 50 years or whatever it is, but
yeah. No. Yeah. Well, I have to say that I enjoyed the series much more than I thought I would. With the rewatch, I'd heard so much about the series being a real letdown after the first two movies of the week by Curtis and Matheson. But I really did enjoy the series, mostly because Darren McGavin just totally inhabits Kolchak. He's always fun. You know, it's either like it's scary or it's like kind of a wink-wink kind of fun. He waltzes this line where he's not a superhero or some John Wayne type that is afraid of nothing, but he's also not a coward like Scooby-Doo and Shaggy, you know. As a journalist, he's always compelled to find the truth, so he's willing to put himself in harm's way. And he's not afraid to ponder the unusual or the unlikely. If he was, there'd be no series. What are your sort of final thoughts on the series and the rewatch, Dave?
I was almost thinking that, you know, we almost need to do an episode just on reporters in genre, because you also have April O'Neil from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
And you have that, the asshole from the Hulk too, who's always like, you know, after him.
Right. And that's what keeps that show running, is that he always tries to keep ahead of, the person, because they're doing a good job in it. So yeah, you're right. It's I'm still a big fan on the movies of the week, but as we talked about in this episode, there were several episodes. It was worth watching all of them because there's always something in it. Like even Updike's or Uptight's comment about the Battle of Hastings in 1066 that comes out of nowhere. I know we're eventually going to get into how it all ends, but we've got little bits here and there that show what the characters are like and how they get involved. Even Vincenzo, when he has to make that big speech and he's trying to get feedback and everyone's there and Kolchak just trying to get the hell out of there. All these nice little scenes that they have in it, or when Kolchak has to write all those letters because someone's away and he has to do all these things and he shoves them all in a desk, you know, that kind of thing. There's always a little bit of comedy. That's one of the most important things, is the comedic elements, the kind of the stuff that makes it a bit light, which makes the dark even darker.
Yeah. And he's just such a likable character, you know.
Oh, like, my God.
Like, you could, you know, like the show could almost exist with, again, the investigative journalist from The Hulk. But that wouldn't be a show you'd want to watch, right? Where this guy is just, like, not pleasant. And, you know, with Kolchak, you know, you want to believe. You know, you want him to eventually get to the point where he unearths something and, you know, he wins a Pulitzer or something for it.
Yeah, it's you're right. I forgot about that, just how endearing and how likable Kolchak, which is partly why people, you know, put up with this bullshit. And also almost like a David Bruce Banner, he's just someone you want to root for, that you want him to succeed despite all the stuff that he has to go through, all the roadblocks, all the issues, all the cameras that he has to reflect. Like that, it was cool. One episode, he actually got to sign out really good camera equipment. And Vincenzo is thinking, okay, please don't muck this up or don't get rid of these. Cause these are real, because the thing he has, do you remember our early cameras? Like,
well, it's like a 110 Kodak camera. Like,
yeah. Cause I had this one with a little flash bulb on it. That was one of my earliest cameras.
Yeah. And they, I mean, 110 film is like, it's like the end of your pinky. Like the negative is like the end of your pinky. And like the resolution would be awful. Like, and he's shooting the stuff and supposedly like, I don't know. It's just, I can't imagine how any of those pictures would work out. So Kolchak, the Night Stalker, ends unceremoniously after its 20th episode, The Sentry. As we've been doing this season, we've tried to create some resolution for shows that just had the plug pulled out on them. So David and I are both going to take a stab at envisioning how it all ends for Kolchak, the Night Stalker. David, would you like to give it a whirl? Do you have some resolution for Karl Kolchak?
Yeah, I certainly don't want to steal your thunder or anything. This is something I've thought about for a while. I think we've talked about this before when we had our episode on the movie, the ABC movie of the week, and looked at the Night Stalker, and which was one of the cruelest endings in a film ever, is the idea that he's taken away from the woman that he loves, and she loves him as well. And
told he can never come back to Las Vegas. Like if he does, you know, yeah, there will be hell to pay.
And they could have let them both, like say you both have to leave and just let them both go off together into the sunset. But no, that what they did was very cruel. I think this may be one of the things that if we were to change it, he would somehow find her and he would be able to reconnect with her. Because that's sort of the romantic that is in us. So sorry if I'm sort of going to steal your thunder a bit, but we did mention that, I think, when we covered the movie of the week. But one thing that I would hope is that if that had continued, then there might have been something where he connects with others, sort of like a Four Horsemen kind of thing, or some group or other people that also get into trying to resolve supernatural things, and it actually starts to be almost more like a Buffy kind of thing.
Oh, that would have been
not
cool.
It would have been not just him, but some other people that he works with that he can come back again with and try to, you know, do this.
Yeah, that would be a great idea.
Yeah.
And I understand there was a brief relaunch, but people were not into it at all. And I wonder if they did that, because that would be a great idea, because it also gives you more options for stories, you know, and for story structure, you know. All right. So for me, I had something similar, but this is sort of was my take. I said, we all know that The Night Stalker began with the made-for-TV movie that was set in Las Vegas. So I think I'd like to wrap up in Vegas, and I definitely want to reunite Kolchak with Gail Foster, the character played by Carol Lindley, his lover from that story, because he was forced by the cops to leave without explaining to her what was going on. So I definitely reunite them. Perhaps she contacts him and begs for his help. She's frantic, going on about vampires and UFOs. We also know that the series and the movies of the week inspired The X-Files, so why not foreshadow a clandestine government agency, maybe involving a young FBI agent, Skinner, who tips Carl off to a link to aliens and the recent rash of paranormal activity. Carl tries to expose it all, but in the end, he has to escape with Gale, while Vincenzo, G-Men, aliens, and monsters are all on his tail. We see an elevated long shot of Carl and Gail Foster in his yellow Mustang convertible as it drives past the "You Are Leaving Las Vegas" sign. Gail says, "Carl, how will we ever get anybody to believe us? Can we ever get anyone to know the..." And Carl says, "What, the truth? Here in Vegas? Never. But out there? Maybe." He points to the open desert road ahead of him. He says, "Let's see if the truth is out there." Gale cuddles into his arm. We see the yellow Mustang convertible drive off into the desert, like you're heading off into the sunset moment, and the credits roll. So that was my how it all ends.
Yeah, for me, I was just looking at Cole Shack, but of course, with Vincenzo, he may finally get that job that he wanted in New York, and maybe, you know, move up in the ranks of newspaper editors.
Yeah, and also he could get a really good gastrointestinal doctor.
I think with Updike, I think he does get his break, but maybe it's because he knows stuff about the Battle of Hastings from 1066 and joins the Society of Creative Anachronism. And he ends up doing all of these things where he dresses up as a knight or something like that. I think that with the Emily, I guess, from Horror in the Heights, and a number of the episodes, she's the older lady actress who was roughly 80 years old, Ruth McDevitt, that with her character, she somehow gets some potion of youth or some fountain or something happens. Sweet. And she becomes like 26 or something like that. And there's all the questions about, well, how do you prove that you're still you, or whether or not she says, oh, I'm the niece now, and you do the will or whatever. But she eventually gets to be maybe a younger person that would go on travels with Cole Shack to resolve, or maybe a series revolves around her. She is now the new Night Stalker or something like that.
Oh, that'd be
but
cool.
I definitely want something with her, for sure.
Yeah, maybe Kolchak is able to go back and go to Seattle and find Richard Anderson's Serum of Youth, and she can use it without having to kill people. That would be good.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, so and I think that brings us to the end of our penultimate episode of our all-TV season, where Two Old Farts meet the Glassed Heat.
Please tell friends about us and check us out on social media. Our website is 2of.ca. And on Facebook, we're just Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. You can join us there to chat and check out our associated posts. You can also post yourself if it's genre related and if you play nice with others.
Yeah, and looking forward in our final episode of the season, we'll be tuning in to Linda Carter's Wonder Woman.
That's going to be a lot of fun. Thanks again for listening.
Yeah, and thank you, David Lynch. Remember that gum you like is going to come back in style.
And the owls are not what they seem.
I'm David Klink.
And I'm Troy Harkin.
And this has been Two Old Farts
Talk Sci-Fi. You can